Matt Segundo here, and I...
How about a game of football, Matt?
Doris, didn't you get the alimony payment?
I did, but it's not enough. But if you'll just kick this football I'm holding, I'm sure we can sort things out okay. You can call it psychiatric help, but you'll be paying a lot more than a nickel.
Come on, Doris! It's not as if I'm paying you peanuts. Besides, my career in sports is over. My head isn't a baseball, and I'm not made out of money.
And perhaps I should call my attorney.
Look, there's no need for that.
Fact. Happiness is a warm pocketbook.
Well, while we sort this out, listen to our young loving correspondent's conversation with a biographer of an icon of our time, or last time, or sometime, or...
Who will write your biography, Bat?
I will!
Okay, so I'm here with David McKellis, who is the author of Schultz and Peanuts. David, how are you doing today?
Great, thank you.
First off, I wanted to sort of get to the nitty-gritty of this. Schultz was a teetotaler. He did not smoke, he did not swear, he did not emotionally express himself, and even recoiled when his mother suggested that he draw more smutty cartoons. Do you feel that Schultz's existential reticence could be pinpointed to one specific thing? I mean, you have in the preface this trajectory of Schultz leaving after his mother's death. Is that where things kind of went astray? Or?
Well, from the beginning of the question, we were talking about teetotaling and not smoking and not swearing. Charles Schultz was so much the product of his Minnesota childhood. And in that childhood, his uncles, who were in his mother's family, Norwegian farmers, who were trying to find their way in the new industrial American culture of the 20s and 30s and struggling. His father, who was a barber, fairly prosperous and doing well, who didn't allow in his shop, you know, grotty talk, smutty talk. He didn't want anything more than a couple of jokes. He certainly didn't have girly pinup calendars. Barbering in the Midwest was coming out of a period where it had been known for being the sort of refuge of alcoholics. By the time Carl Schultz became a barber, it was highly licensed. He was a man in a trade that was examined almost to the level of doctors in later years. At any rate, all this is to say that Charles Schultz would never have wanted to drink because his uncles, who were out of control sometimes, would have given him a bad example of that. His father's shining example of a guy who controlled himself and his world to the degree that he really did succeed through this great cataclysm of the Depression, left Schultz feeling that dignity and calmness and honor and a sense of uprightness was the way he wanted to live his life.
Gotcha. I'm wondering, though, you pinpoint the origins of Lucy in terms of being a reflection of Schultz's first wife, Joyce. And you also have, you know, what are the other origins of the characters? I mean, you don't really mention Woodstock, for example, and you only give Franklin literally about half a sentence. What about the other sort of characters who didn't come from your own particular personal observations? Or was your focus here on more how the strips reflected Schultz's life? Or?
Well, I found that the characters, as I moved along in them, were constantly revealing not only their greatness as comic strip characters, because Schultz's genius, I think, was to find in character the greatest expression of human beings. I mean, it was character that drove the strip. It was character that drove Charles Dickens's novels. It's the kind of character that characterization creates humor and creates the daily action of the strip. I think he was looking into his own life when he developed Charlie Brown, certainly when he developed Lucy, who was very much modeled first on his daughter, his oldest daughter, and then took on the patterns of some of his first wife's personality. I think Linus is quite clearly himself in certain ways. He embedded aspects of himself, his perfectionism in Schroeder, his wishy-washiness in Charlie Brown, his own sarcasm and occasional meanness, as he described it, to Lucy. And he divvied up parts of himself this way and reserved, in some ways, the more complicated aspects of his dreaming personality, his wishful, ambitious side that was constantly being deflated, to Snoopy. And so you keep seeing Schultz in his many parts of his personality in the characters. And then you learn little bits of lore, such as Pigpen was so much the result of observing his son Craig's constantly muddy clothing coming home from dirt biking. His son Monty was the source for the earliest Red Baron episodes. To each of his children, he ascribed a strip or two and the ideas behind them. And to his art instruction, Inc. colleagues, those were artists and cartoonists and others who he worked with at Art Instruction, Inc., a correspondence school in Minneapolis during the years after the war. Each of them had names that he borrowed. Linus Maurer became the source for the name Linus. Linus Maurer of Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. The idea of a security blanket cropped up when he was in Colorado Springs in the early 50s, and one of his closest friends there, a guy he'd been in the war with, Phil Fritz Van Pelt, had studied the whole idea of security then being put out and in psychological terms, and was with Sparky one night when his daughter Meredith, Sparky's daughter Meredith, lost her bunny rabbit, actually, not even a blanket, but a bunny rabbit, and Fritz Van Pelt said to Sparky, when Sparky wouldn't automatically return the bunny to her, but in fact hid it somewhere in the house, he said, "Sparky, you're messing with her security." And the idea of a transitional object was then being put forth for the first time in psychology. All this were the kinds of elements that contributed to the development of Schultz's ideas and devices and characters.
But what of things like, for example, the kite-eating tree? I mean, there's no specific connection, at least I found in this particular book. And again, I had brought up Franklin as well as a couple of other characters. I mean, is it certainly an artist when he sets down to go ahead and put his art? It draws also from personal experience as well as invention. So I guess, how does looking into Schultz's life really kind of give us this idea of what Peanuts is all about? Or is it really more about Schultz's life?
Well, I think Schultz's life contributes to a far larger picture, and it can reveal more about Peanuts and where Peanuts came from. But the kite-eating tree is such a great example, and I'm glad you brought it up, because the kite-eating tree, Schroeder's piano, Lucy's psychiatric booth, these were genius intuitions. These were ideas the artist is having that aren't necessarily coming out of life. I mean, the psychiatric booth is a great sophisticated joke because, of course, it's the lemonade stand, the child's lemonade stand, turned into this incredibly outrageous, for the time, almost taboo idea that a kid was going to become a psychiatrist and hand out, you know, analysis for a nickel. That was a very that was like a New Yorker cartoon, really. That it was that level. You almost never found that level of sophistication in the mainstream comics. The kite-eating tree is one of those brilliant things that when you look at it, the more you look at it, the more you see it, the more you shake your head and wonder at how Charles Schultz did create these absolutely brilliant pictographs of some of our worst fears, of some of our, you know, inmost desires. Schroeder's piano strikes me as fabulous because here he's saying, look at this boy man who has no interest in the girl, by the way, who's at the end of the piano. He's totally devoted to his art, but he's playing these masterworks of world symphony, of world music, on a toy piano, on something where the keys are painted on. Well, that's such a metaphor for Schultz creating great art on this on the toy piano of the comic strips, which were in those days looked at, you know, as something that would be really not as important in any way at all, and certainly not important enough to send an artist to the Louvre with his work, which is what happened to Schultz eventually. He became a guy whose art was shown at the Louvre, whose art is more and more accepted as art in its own right, and I think he never trusted that was going to happen and never believed it would, and to find the kind of edge that you find in Peanuts is a constant expression, really, of, I think, Schultz's fears and anxieties and his joy in life and his real sense of irony and his real sense of sweetness and all the things that he was able to bring up in the daily strips, in the Sunday pages, are coming right out of his heart and soul.
But also a coping mechanism, perhaps, or just a sort of, maybe he may just be having fun. Maybe we're actually reading too much significance in his work. Bill Watterson, in his review of this book of the Wall Street Journal, suggested that Lucy was also a very great tragic figure who also had a kind of universal appeal. And regardless of Schultz's flaws, I mean, I'm wondering why, as he pointed out, he actually hoped that you had gone into more analysis of the art along the lines of what we're talking about. So why prioritize the personal over the actual art itself? The book is called Schultz and Peanuts.
A biography, and there you go. I mean, I invite Bill Watterson over to my office to look at all the outtakes. There are thousands. The first draft was 1,800 pages. This is a 533-page printed book. the work of having to reduce the thorough first draft is where, in some ways, the art of biography takes place. Everyone can select from the great mass, but coming down into the level where you have to choose for story and choose not to let the reader drift off into encyclopedic renditions of art and life. Here's the problem. You have a limited amount of space in which to tell not only the story of the life, but in some ways the way the life is impacting on the art and the way the art is influencing the life, and also in this case, the times in which Schultz lived, which were very important, as was the country itself. Schultz is in so many ways, and Peanuts is in Peanuts is in so many ways an American self-conception. We find ourselves in this art, we find ourselves in the comics, but we specifically find ourselves in these characters and in their doings. And from the 50s to the 60s, into the 70s, you see the culture absolutely mirroring symmetrically Schultz's initiatives. In Snoopy, for instance, you find even the flutter dance, Snoopy's great joyous moment of dancing, that's coming at a time where kids, teenagers, young people, then called hippies in some parts anyway, were finding themselves. They wanted to be tuned into nothing but ecstasy. I mean, Snoopy dances around like he's stoned. He isn't, of course, and Schultz isn't making any comment on drugs or the drug culture. But he was asking the questions, what is happiness, that the hippie movement embraced, that the whole idealism of the 60s embraced. There was a moment I discovered in San Francisco when the Jefferson Airplane was in a recording studio, and it turned out that the kids who were recording the voices of the kids, the children in A Charlie Brown Christmas, were in the next door studio, and it was the Jefferson Airplane who made the trip over to the neighboring studio to see the kids who were the Peanuts characters in the famously unadult, in the world of Peanuts which had no adults in it, a world in a way where idealism, where kids could maybe remake the world. It was part of the whole moment, really. There were a group called Sopwith Camel, based on Snoopy's great airplane. There was a great moment where you found, you know, drummers, I mean, the organist, actually, in Grateful Dead, nicknamed Pigpen. Bikers were known as Pigpen. The astronauts were going to the moon with spacecraft nicknamed Charlie Brown and Snoopy. It was the one thing in the 60s that everybody could agree on. Mm-hmm. And if you understand how much Schultz became all things to all people, I would say that really you begin to understand what the art of comics can do and what the extraordinary reach of Schultz was at his most intuitive. But for me, I had to keep writing the story of his life. I had to keep coming back and telling what was he doing next, because the biography is the story of a person becoming what they're going to be and making choices along the way and being presented with alternatives and then making a choice. And in that choice comes the, for the reader, I hope, a moment where they understand who he really is and what kind of character and personality he's working with, because the choices you make are the things that tell the most about you.
You likewise also point out that Peanuts was in many ways sort of a prism for all sorts of ideologies to kind of look at this and see, well, this is the social commentary. It's speaking for us. The left, the right. Robert Short wrote his book, The Gospel According to Peanuts. So I'm wondering, though, if is there a certain kind of danger in looking at Peanuts too closely? Or I mean, because it seems to me that in many ways it was designed in a very abstract manner, in a very specific sort of manner, so that even if we actually go ahead and apply this personal correlation between Schultz's life and the actual work, it may not necessarily be the case, even though there are very striking and explicit references from the panels and what you've dug up.
Well, Schultz certainly understood that Peanuts was all things to all people, and all people actually found themselves in Peanuts, to the extent that a strip that he did in the 60s in which Sally comes home from school, and by the very last panel, it's a silent strip, and in the very last panel of the Sunday page, she's got Charlie Brown behind the sofa and she's whispering to him, and she says, "We prayed in school today." Well, that cartoon was requested by both sides of the prayer in school debate. For their newsletters, it was understood to be as equally applicable to either side of this, at the time, raging political debate. Well, Schultz had his own feelings about the prayer in school issue, and he kept them to himself. And he kept saying, I think, look, I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a politician. I am who I am. He didn't mean a reference to Popeye, but he was constantly saying, I'm not going to be what you would all have me be. Yesterday, in fact, I was talking to someone and they said, wasn't he a socialist? I mean, he is so misunderstood by so many people in so many ways that it's hard to, you know, it's hard to believe that one guy could be all these different things. But I think that in some ways, when you get back to the essence of it, he was always the boy from Minnesota. He was always the kid who wanted to be the cartoonist. He was always the kid who couldn't find in the world what he wanted, even though the world ultimately rewarded him beyond beyond all measure, without any precedent in the comics.
I wanted to actually talk about the panels that you actually got from United Feature Syndicate. I was wondering, did they set any specific sort of conditions in terms of the context of how you were using it in the book, or was it just a matter of just obtaining permission? Are they still protecting the Peanuts legacy?
Well, United Media, which is the company that syndicates all things Peanuts around the globe, it's now an extremely large, and became in the 90s, an extremely large concern. Just the Peanuts strip alone became a brand registering gross sales annually of about $1.2 billion. United Media has been very generous with me all along. They first allowed me a password to their United Media comic strip library through which I could go and see Peanuts every single day. It was published for 50 years. I could look through the 17,897 strips with a single word search. I could find every time that Schultz discussed the word love. I could just find every time he discussed the security blanket, or I could look at it linear, I could look at it upside down, I could look at it sideways, and it was sort of like the glass elevator in Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. I had only to press a button and off I'd go to that room, so to speak.
Wow.
Well, it saved me, needless to say, the work of years, number one, but it also was another way of looking at Peanuts, another way of seeing the themes collect. And I guess I got to answer your question in two ways, which is first to say United Media, you know, my new best friend, because they charged me a nickel a strip. They put no conditions on the usage, except that each strip be, well, they put conditions on it. I had to publish the whole strip. I couldn't publish details. But they charged me a nickel a strip for the simple and sentimental reason that that's what Lucy charged at her psychiatric booth. And I had paid enormous sums to publish the work of the artist N.C. Wyeth in an earlier biography. And I took it as a gesture on United Media's part of being, we're all in this together. Peanuts is a great, huge thing. We all should see it, and certainly they understood and recognized that I call the book Schultz and Peanuts because they are unified. The life and the work are so close that to see them together is a way of really coming to a new understanding of Peanuts and appreciating it again and loving it. I mean, I got up every morning and laughed. I mean, it was astonishing to see this genius at work every day. Well, the other part of it is, yes, you're right. You can look too closely at things. You know, you can get too wrapped up. It is just a comic strip. It is just a joke at times. But other times when you see themes develop and recur, it's saying something more. Even those times where he isn't aware of it, where Schultz, for instance, I'm not sure that he was aware of this, but I noticed it, which was, again, a way of, I found this because of being able to look up the simple idea of the hurt stomach. Well, Charlie Brown is constantly grabbing his stomach and feeling great pain through his stomach because of something outrageous that Lucy has just said. In fact, he greets so many of Lucy's insane remarks with this moment of saying, oh, I can't stand it, and he grabs his stomach. Well, Charlie Brown stops having a bad stomach soon after Charles Schultz was divorced from his first wife, on whom the character Lucy was based. You rarely, if ever, hear again about a hurt stomach in all of Peanuts. I think that there was certain parallels that were happening in his life. I mean, I was stunned, for example, to discover, oh my gosh, here's Charlie Brown throwing Lucy off the baseball team, and to find then, oh, this is the period in which he was divorcing from his first wife. And that was his answer, in some ways, to the whole question of who was going to leave whom first. He let Charlie Brown do it. And there's Lucy saying, if you fire me from this team, I'll never speak to you again. And the final panel is Lucy yelling, but I'll sure yell at you a lot. And I think there's a way when you also realize at the same time that Snoopy is on his doghouse maybe a week later, I can't remember the exact date, but falling in love with a girl beagle, and a girl beagle who has soft paws, and he's wondering why he fell in love with her, and realizing it's all about the teasing and the wonderful relationship he's having with this girl beagle. Then, lo and behold, I discover Schultz at the time himself was falling in love and having a relationship with a young woman who worked at the telephone company in Northern California, and who had soft hands, and with whom he had wonderful teasing moments. The parallels between his life and the strip just kept cropping up to the point where a biographer really couldn't avoid it. I couldn't, you know, had to make some sense of this. But on the other hand, I would hate to think that the student of comics or the casual reader or even the student of art history wouldn't be able to look at Peanuts just simply as a work of art without anything to do with his life at all.
You also are looking at this, obviously, extremely closely over the course of 7 years. And Lucy, did, if she was reflective of his first wife, didn't exactly disappear. She still was the sort of loud, boisterous, vociferous spirit throughout the course of Peanuts. Maybe there might have been some modification later on as he was getting older and he was mellowing to some degree.
Definitely.
But inevitably, and some of the actual strips that you dig up are quotes that actually occur years after they actually arrive. So, I mean, I'm wondering, though, if he's just sort of, I guess, is it really sort of fair to draw that particular close connection every single time that it's absolutely that moment that Lucy is like that, or that it's you're characterizing a particular character in relation to his life?
Well, some of it, of course, is intuition on my part or conjecture. I mean, there's a period in when his marriage was coming apart where he goes into where Charlie Brown wakes up one morning and it turns out the sun is a baseball, and then Charlie Brown's own head is suddenly seamed like a baseball, and then everything Charlie Brown touches or gets near is suddenly a baseball, and he goes to a doctor and discovers that the only thing he can do is really put a paper bag over his head and go off to camp. Well, he goes off to camp, and instead of becoming a loser at camp, he actually turns out that summer to become a great leader, and he's giving advice to the other campers, and they're coming to him because of his great leadership skills, because he's got a sack over his head. They call him Mr. Sack. Well, you know, I'm not a doctor. I'm not even much of an analyst. But look, sad sacks were what World War II veterans were called. Charlie Brown is at a camp. Charles Schulz lost his mother 4 days. She was buried, and she died and was buried 4 days before he went into the army. He went off in a khaki uniform, a sad sack, and he went off as a very sad sack. He was ruined. He was destroyed. He was traumatized and completely unhappy, having lost his mother and his childhood at the same time. And he went off to Camp Campbell, Kentucky. Instead of becoming a loser, as he thought he was and as everyone expected him to be, he became a leader, just like Charlie Brown. His men in a machine gun squad in the 20th Armored Division came to him for advice. His advice, they told him what an incredible leader he was. They were so surprised to be with and following such a great guy. Charles Schulz was much beloved by his army unit, as he was by so many of his fans in later life. They recognized his great qualities, and this is what happened to Charlie Brown in that moment during the 60s. And I have to just think that there's something about waking up to the nightmare. And I remember seeing this when I was a kid, and I've talked to people my age who remember this. But it was disturbing to see the sun as a baseball. There was something really surreal and weird about it. And if you think about it, there's nothing, no images like that in the comics. It's really almost like out of surreal art. And there's something about the seams, the sense of being stitched up and recovering from something. And Charlie Brown's got to go to the doctor, and he's feeling sick. And this is a guy who's, you know, who's terrified of what's happening and happened in the world and happened to his world. Baseballs aren't baseballs anymore, and ice cream cones aren't ice cream cones. There's something wrong. And that's a recapitulation to me of that whole period of Charles Schulz's life in the early 1940s when his mother died and he went off to war. Is that Charles Schulz's idea when he drew it? I can't say, but I do know that when he talked about those strips and that particular sequence, he always identified it as being one of his favorite and one of the things that he said came out of somewhere. He never would say where, but there was something important about it, and he indicated its significance.
All this is fair enough, but you were mentioning earlier about this being conjecture, and yet this has received a good deal. You've been actually on a lot of fire by the Schulz family. You told New York Times reporter Patricia Cohen, did I get the story right? Absolutely. No question. And so what I'm wondering is what is the difference between ferreting out or confirming a fact and this kind of more speculative approach? I mean, what...
Well, I bring the speculative into an intuitive sense of what the art is saying, and sometimes one has to merely place dates beside the strips to see and recognize how they're relating to the life. I'm absolutely scrupulous about the facts as I can, near as I can get them. They're going to be a mistake here and there. I even noticed one or two since the book was published, which pains me no end, misspelling here, a misunderstanding there. There's no question that a book will be corrected in its final, you know, months before. I tried very hard to make sure things were right. I do feel in a very strong sense that the story, and the point I was making to Patricia Cohen, of which there was only a quote that remained, but is that biography has two points at which accuracy are vital. It's vital to be accurate about the facts, as close as you can be, It's also vital to be accurate about the story. And that's what I mean by did I get the story right. This is a story of an artist. It's a story of a complicated man. I believe Charles Schulz was not a simple man. I believe that when I started research, the telling of his story at the time was often as a simple guy, as a humble, mild, meek guy. It was all at face value. The sense of Schulz as a mild-mannered fellow from St. Paul, who was probably not a very good businessman, who had, as they said in Congress the day they gave him the gold medal, had machine-gunned his way across Europe. All these sort of myths about Schulz, that he was an evangelical Christian all his life, that he was not a good businessman, that he was not very intelligent because he would always tell people that he was dumb. I thought it was my job to correct the inaccuracies in the way his story had been told, to try to size up from everyone who knew him and all the available data and primary source material, a rendering of his life that you could say, he was a complicated guy, and here are some of the complications, and let's try to understand, to the extent that we can, where some of the sources of his great art came from.
But was this a matter of wanting to, overturn an American icon, or just, at least take away some of the shiny sheen from the veneer?
I never had what I thought of as an agenda to write a debunking biography or to take anything away from Schulz and Peanuts, but I did think it was my job not to get Charles Schulz, but to get him, to understand him, to get under his skin, to see what made him tick. I think every biography is seeking to understand what made that person the person they became, and the only way to do that is by telling the truth as you're told it. If you begin to withhold or whitewash in order to make the icon sparkle the more and withhold the stories and we tend to, as a culture right now, not being able to see any gray area at all. We're in a black and white moment in our culture where we seem to think, for some reason, how dare he come forward with a story that's, sounds like it might not be fit into some wonderful image. It's like there's a dumpster out back and we're supposed to take any story that's bad and put it in the dumpster and put anything that's good in the book. Well, this is a sort of moral or moralistic approach to human beings that I don't share. And that I think really the humanity of someone is that with which both, let me put it this way. Schulz was not afraid to tell the truth to us about who we were in Peanuts. I feel it's my job to be unafraid to tell as I can, insofar as I can understand it, the truth I know about Charles Schulz in a biography of his life.
I totally understand that, but I'm also looking at the source notes. A lot of it is arranged in this kind of topical manner. And so if one wants to corroborate a quote, if a naysayer of yours who is quibbling with this, and there have been, obviously, the family's been saying, he betrayed us, wouldn't it have been a more effective manner to actually go ahead and attribute each quote exactly instead of putting it into this thing?
Absolutely. In fact, I regret the decision exceedingly because I made the decision to do the source notes in the manner you just described, simply for the sake of length. When I wrote N.C. Wyeth, a biography, all my sources were attributed by page to exact quotes keyed to the exact words, and those notes are maybe triple the length of the current notes. And because this was a book that was perceived by HarperCollins as having a wide audience, they were trying to find ways to suggest to me as the author, they were very considerate of my concerns, but trying to find any way they could to say, look, here's where, if you want to include another 30 pages of text, you might be able to save a few pages on notes by trying it in this way. There's two or three prescribed ways in the Chicago Manual style. This happens to be one of the prescribed ways, but as you say, it's not as clear for the reader. I didn't realize that there would be so much scrutiny given to every quote. I figured that I would be trusted and indeed, if you want to figure out, there's a code, in other words, with the current notes. If you want to figure it out, it's all there. It just takes a little longer. You have to kind of work with a key in order to figure out who's who and what those initials are and so forth and so on. It's harder to find your way through it, but the sourcing is no less accurate and no less reliable than in any other form.
Sure. For example, the Tracy Claudius affair. I mean, maybe we can sort of talk about how these notes led to speculation versus effect. Like, I looked at that particular thing and I saw that there was an actual audio tape that you had actually uncovered from 1970 recorded in the ice rink, along with several letters as well as interviews that you conducted. What steps do you take before you actually know something? Because you're dealing with a good deal of subjective views of a particular particular situation. So how do you determine it objectively? Or is it a matter of actually adopting some sort of subjective stance as to the events that transpired.
Well, you're always trying to figure out if what you're being told is close to the truth. And a lot of that, of course, you're judging. You might misjudge someone, but you're trusting yourself to figure out whether you think the person that you're talking to is giving you the truth as they know it. And if you spend enough time, I spent several days initially with Tracy Claudius, who was the young woman Schultz had become enamored of at the very end of his quite then strained marriage, and the woman he fell in love with deeply and with whom he began writing letters. To see Schultz in the letters, to see Schultz in the drawings that he sent to Tracy Claudius, a large collection of several dozen to start with, and then probably up to as many as 100, one was to see Schultz in love. These were not fakes. These were authentic and real, and his feelings in them are authentic and real. And if nothing else, they provided, as very few other relationships in his later life did, these letters and documents, a way of seeing in a scholarly way what was going on. I mean scholarly in the sense of here's the page, here's what's on the page. Well, to have the person to whom he wrote the letters also available to talk at length, in no sense a superficial meeting, to go through point by point, step by step, sometimes sentence by sentence, this correspondence, to recognize with her in looking back what she could see now and what she had understood then, to have a sense from other friends of hers whom I talked to and interviewed, a cousin of hers, was to make absolutely clear that here was somebody who was authentic and real and who was reliable. And in most cases, I tried to find at least two people who would, in effect, tell me the same thing, or who would back each other up, or where you would not be simply going out on a limb based on one person's evidence. But Tracy Claudius also, in her later years, had looked into the relationship herself in order to perhaps write something about it, and she had made records herself of her own reactions. So I wasn't even getting, you know, off-the-cuff responses. I was getting considered, thoughtful, emotional reality and truth, I think, for someone who felt very deeply, and to me was a very smart person, actually, and very closely had tracked her own feelings, and I think really understood Sparky, and as he was called, in ways that, you know, it would be hard for me to find someone less... it'd be hard for me to find someone more sensitive than Tracy Claudius.
I'm curious also as to why you didn't include the negotiations with Eric Reynolds at Fantagraphics, because Schultz was actually negotiating this during the course of his life, and to me this seems, in terms of what you present, this final kind of consideration that, okay, maybe this early artwork that I didn't care for actually does have some value. Maybe I should be preserving my
posterity. I'm sorry, what negotiations are we talking about?
The volumes that are being issued by Fantagraphics now. During the end of Schultz's life, they actually managed to work out a situation so that now we are fortunately experiencing these very beautiful editions of Peanuts.
I agree.
So what I'm wondering is like, this seems to me something that kind of goes against this predicament, and this will be the last question because I know you gotta go, of Schultz trying to initially being sort of ashamed and also having something of an ego, and then he finally sort of accepts that he has to actually lay down a legacy. That seems to me sort of a significant development at the end of his life.
Well, I was surprised by a number of things in his studio, which I was privileged enough to spend some time in when I first began researching. And I'm the son of a German-born engineer and who was very organized, and I kind of, I guess, chip off the old block, became sort of an organized type myself, and biography actually has its own pleasures because you get to kind of create a mini archive in your very own home of all these things you're finding, and you have to keep it pretty organized for it all to make sense in the end. I figured Schultz, being the kind of guy who had written 17,897 strips, would have kept very careful records of his life and work, and that they'd all be nicely, neatly organized out there at one Snoopy place at Creative Associates, which is the arm of his work where the business part was taken over. When Schultz was in his studio, he'd be surrounded, you know, in other rooms in the building by three or four or five people who were working on different parts of the Peanuts business. I figured that with assistants working in that way, and he himself being who he was, there would be much more sense of his life being a carefully organized thing. On the contrary, it turned out he had routinely thrown things away. His secretaries were quite astonished to see what ended up in the garbage. They were sort of reluctant to, the assistants and receptionists even were reluctant to pull things out of the trash, although I learned from a a guy who was one of the handymen there that, you know, sometimes earlier on in life, people would come and actually pick stuff out of the dumpster before a gate was put up. So there was a sense that Schultz didn't care so much about the record of his life. But then at the end of his life, several things happened. One, his wife, Jeannie, began with several friends in Santa Rosa, Ed Anderson and another close friend of Schultz's were involved in creating a museum. And it was their wish that he begin, and they begin to create an archive. My papers from my research will go into that archive by understanding, by agreement. And they found whenever Schultz was throwing things out, they would simply ask someone to iron out that balled up piece of paper. He was beginning to have an awareness, I think, of his legacy. He certainly was beginning for the first time to have an awareness when he retired of all of our, of the world's, of his readers, of his fans, love and admiration and affection for him. And it was something of a revelation, it seemed, even then, that people cared as much as they did about Peanuts, about him and what he'd done. That last interview with Al Roker, you see him, you know, tearing up, and of course he'd had a stroke, and he was well past the point of you know, being a guy fully in control of all his faculties, and was, you know, crying, I think, probably as much from the stroke as anything else. But there was behind it a kind of moment of vulnerability there, where he realized people did care about him and did love what he did, and he was still stunned and amazed by that. He was never sure that he was getting what he wanted from the world. He was giving an awful lot to the world. He was a very generous guy, and I think to get it back finally shaped for him in some way the first signs of you know, what he'd wanted all his life, which was love and attention and a sense of being valued in a way that he never had when he was a child. I guess he never had, because he certainly seemed to miss it.
Gotcha. Well, I know you have to go, but David, thanks so much for talking with me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
In the auditorium, Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown, he's a clown. That's Charlie Brown. He's gonna get down. Guess you wait and see.
Why's everybody always picking on me?
Guess you're gonna need, I know.